طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. I want to begin this morning with a Mondo Weiss article written by Palestinian journalist, activist, and former co-host of This Week in Palestine, Samer Jaber. We first met Samer in 2007 in his hometown of Bethlehem in the West Bank, and later collaborated with him when he came to Brandeis University to study for his master's degree. Samer, a passionate activist in the Palestinian struggle for justice, became a co-host of This Week in Palestine with me, and we did the program each week until he graduated with his master's degree and returned to Bethlehem. In the New Year's greeting that Samer sent to us, he included this recent article he wrote for Mondo Weiss. The article reveals the intense integrity of this intrepid journalist, and I'm going to read it now. Quote, "In January of this year, a group of individuals, including myself, who applied to work at the Local Aid Coordination Secretariat, LACS, part of the Palestinian Authority, Prime Minister's Office, met with Dr. Mohammed Shetayeh, the Prime Minister. Dr. Shetayeh, who likes to show that he is close to people, utilized this opportunity to assure us that the process of hiring is transparent, with no nepotism and no corruption. He also assured us that his government abides by the rule of law. The PA, he affirmed, should match its national agenda priorities with donor communities and conditions. In order to be able to get donors' community support. Then he asked us to introduce ourselves and to give each one's perspective about aid. By the end of this meeting, Dr. Shetayeh raised a question. Did you think the Palestinian Legislative Council elections will take place? The entire group said yes, except me, who said no. He asked individuals why they said yes, and they replied because the PA President Abbas said so. Then the Prime Minister asked me directly why I didn't think so. I replied by saying that the internal balance and power struggle within Fatah is a major impediment to overcome, and that Fatah is not ready for this. Later on, as a consultant with the International Donor Agency, I had a meeting at the LACS office. By that time, they had already hired their staff. I was surprised because usually if a person reached the interview level, the hiring agency sends an apologizing email to candidates who were not hired. I was also surprised because I had studied at some of the best American schools, Brandeis, Harvard, and MIT, and have rich experience in international development, but had no opportunity with this vacancy. However, what surprised me even more was the LACS. Their faces were not familiar, and it appears that many of the individuals hired to the position did not even attend the interview meeting. In late April, the PA President Abbas announced that he was going to postpone the imminent PA Legislative Council elections without any arrangement for a new date. He did this without consulting with the other 37 running lists. It was widely understood that he did this because Fatah was facing an internal power struggle and fragmentation, which would lead to certain defeat. My friend Nizar Banat, who was the head of the Freedom and Dignity List and a civil rights activist, criticized the PA decision to postpone the elections. He called on European countries and international donors to stop funding the PA until the PA executive branch abided by the people's demand for the holding of legislative elections. A few weeks later, Banat was abducted and extrajudicially killed by PA security apparatus personnel. The attack on Banat that ended with his extrajudicial assassination was not committed because Banat criticized the corruption of the PA alone, but because he and his election list asked the PA donors to freeze their funding until the elections were held. This was the tipping point, because the PA is heavily indebted and suffers from shortages of funds. The International Fund is the ventilator machine that keeps the PA alive since its establishment. Banat was a staunch supporter of the Palestinian Popular Hirak civil-based movement. He represented people's voices in criticizing the corrupt and undemocratic policy enacted by the PA. Therefore, people took to the streets to protest his killing and demanded that the perpetrators face trial. The PA took a few weeks, as it first resorted to denial that it was a premeditated political crime to hold the perpetrators accountable. The civil society organization, along with Banat's family, demanded that the PA take responsibility and apologize for the killing. This is because the PA Prime Minister, who also serves as Interior Minister, is responsible for the Palestinian security apparatus. However, the PA resorted to the quelling of the people's protests and sit-ins. Ironically, representatives of the PA were willing to apologize for the killing of Banat when they gave interviews to European news outlets, as they wanted to show that the PA is willing to take responsibility, but it never apologized to the Palestinian people in Arabic, openly and directly. This let people see the PA leader as paying lip service to the rule of law, but in practice they run the PA business as usual by balancing the nepotism with political support. For the European and even the Americans, it is a matter of embarrassment. They have been funding directly or indirectly democratic and human rights programs and have provided training to the security apparatus in respecting human rights and the rule of law. While the Europeans only expressed their shock and sadness in their statement, and the Americans said they were deeply disturbed by the death of Banat, they can do more. They can tie funding to respect for human rights. However, Europeans and Americans will not be compelled to pressure the PA as long as this corruption does not affect the viability of the coordination between Israel and the PA in terms of delivering both calm and the delusion of the possible political settlement of the conflict. Also, as long as this corruption and these human rights violations stay beneath the surface and do not contribute to social unrest, which would lead to political instability. The silence of the international community, encouraged by the PA government to eliminate freedom of expression from the Palestinian Code of Conduct for the civil service by expunging Article 22 of Cabinet Resolution Number 4 of 2020. The very thing civil society organizations, including political factions, condemned. These attacks on the freedom of speech go beyond the PA's institutions to institutions controlled by PA supporters, including those in academia who follow the footsteps of their leaders. What happened to me recently is an example. During the 2021 academic year, I was teaching democracy and human rights courses in the summer at Al-Quds University as an adjunct instructor. In one of the lectures, I asked the students about extrajudicial killing as a violation of human rights and wondered if the Nizar Banat case came under this category. The lecture was via Zoom. 2 days later, I found out that I could not stream my lectures and the course was stopped without me being informed. I inquired about the issue and was told that I was talking politics in my lectures. So I took to Twitter to protest this. Under pressure from public opinion, which was against this action, and the students' demand to be able to complete this course, the university decided to let me finish the course by giving the students the final exam. The university also decided that they will not contact me in the future, and thus I will not be able to teach there again. The Nizar Banat extrajudicial killing is just the tip of the iceberg of corruption. Under the current circumstances, two things can pressure the PA to respect the rule of law. Nationally, Palestinian civil society, along with ordinary citizens, can raise their voice and protest the existing situation of corruption and muzzling people's voices. The second thing is the role of the donor community, which usually ties its funds to political conditions, but this time they could tie the funds to the PA respecting human rights and the rule of law. This concludes the article written by Samer Javer for Mondo Weiss. The same kind of pressure that was administered to Samer at Al-Quds University in the West Bank of Palestine, which led to his dismissal as an adjunct professor, is also occurring at universities throughout the United States at the behest of the powerful Israeli lobby. It is a continuing story that we closely follow on This Week in Palestine. And now on to our feature presentation, which is an interview of Israeli historian Ilan Pappe by British journalist Peter Bolton on the Canary Channel in the United Kingdom. The Canary has nothing whatsoever to do with the Israeli lobby's Canary Mission blacklist. The Canary is left-leaning, UK-based online publication and is generally critical of Israel and is pro-Palestinian in its coverage. Here is Peter Bolton in conversation with Ilan Pappe on Nakba Day in May of 2021.
All right. Hello, Canary readers. Today, I am very excited to have with us Professor Ilan Pappe. Professor Pappe is a historian. He is a professor at the University of Exeter. He is the author of many books, including On Palestine, which was, I believe, was co-written with Noam Chomsky, The Ethnic Cleansing of the Palestinians, 10 Myths About Israel, and many other historical books about Palestine and the Israel-Palestine conflict. He's also a politician and has stood for office for the Knesset on the Hadash ticket. Professor Pape, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on in your show, Peter. I'm very glad to be with you.
Excellent. Anyway, well, today is a very special day for the Palestinian Solidarity Movement and for Palestinians and their history and their country. Today, May 15th, which is the day that we're recording this, at least, is Al-Nakba Day. Now, I'll just hand it over to Professor Pape. Could you explain to our listeners, our readers who don't have a huge knowledge about what Al-Nakba is, what is it, what happened, and what is its significance today for Palestinians?
Yes, definitely. The word Al-Nakba literally means in Arabic catastrophe, and it refers to the event that occurred in Palestine in the years 1947 and 1948. Actually, it began with the British decision in February 1947 to bring to an end the British rule over Palestine that lasted for about 30 years. As a result of the vacuum created by the British decision to leave, the Zionist movement that was preparing for that moment in history was able to organize and prepare a systematic project of ethnic cleansing that began at the very end of 1947 and lasted until the very end of 1948. So when we talk about the catastrophe, we're talking about an ethnic cleansing operation perpetrated by the Zionist movement and later by the State of Israel, because by May 48, the Zionist movement succeeds in establishing the State of Israel. And in the process of this ethnic cleansing, the Zionists and later the Israeli forces expel half of Palestine's population, make half of Palestine's population refugees, destroy half of Palestine's villages, which are about five, destroyed about 500 villages out of 1,000, and demolished most of the Palestinian neighborhoods in mixed Arab-Jewish towns, or totally destroyed Palestinian towns. I should add to this that this is not just a destruction of houses and expulsion of people. This is, of course, also a destruction of their businesses, their schools, their cultural heritage. It's a destruction of a country as well as of the people who lived on it.
In your book, 10 Myths About Israel, you talk about how there has been a distortion, a misrepresentation of what happened in the Nakba, and that has been used as part of Zionist ideology and propaganda to try to discredit, to misrepresent what happened in the Nakba, to perhaps even denying it outright for the benefit of Israel and its public image.
Yes. Yes. You know, Zionism as a whole is a project of propaganda and does not only, as I showed in my book, The 10 Myths of Israel, it does not only focus on 48. I mean, there are other historical chapters which are presented through a narrative that totally denies the existence of the Palestinians in Palestine before 48, denies the Nakba, the catastrophe, and denies many things that happened afterwards. With more particular emphasis of 48, the narrative I grew on as an Israeli Jew was that actually in 1947, the United Nations offered a very generous and reasonable idea of dividing Palestine into two states. The Palestinians and the Arabs rejected it. The Arab world declared war on Israel and asked the Palestinians to leave so as to make way for the invading Arab armies. The Israelis tried to convince the Palestinians to stay, but they wanted to leave. And that's why the refugee problem was created. And miraculously, Israel succeeded in fending off the attack from the Arab world. It was kind of a miracle, giving the balance of power. What happens is, when you go to the archives, First of all, you see that the balance of power was in favor of Israel in terms of military power, not in terms of population. Of course, there were many more people in the Arab world than there were in the Jewish community. But in terms of people with capacity to fight, the Jewish community had the upper hand all over throughout the Nakba. Secondly, you find out that the Jordanians at the time had a secret agreement with the Jewish leadership in Palestine, which totally neutralized the only Arab army that might have saved the Palestinians. And of course, you find out the proof, which is undeniable proof, for the planning of the ethnic cleansing. And there's no evidence whatsoever of any attempt to convince the Palestinians to stay. On the contrary, there's plenty of evidence for the massive expulsion and the prevention of Palestinians from returning, the flattening of their villages and neighborhoods, and the planting on them of either forests or building on them Jewish settlements. So there is a version that you will still, a narrative if you want, that you will still find an Israeli foreign ministry website. This is still the version that Israeli children are getting in school, in high school. This is what they hear in the army. This is what the official Israeli media is talking about. So this is not easy to debunk inside Israel. Outside Israel, I think most people do not subscribe. I'm sorry, I'm talking to you from Palestine, and you can hear now the Israeli jet Air Force going again to bomb Gaza live.
Goodness.
Okay.
Well,
sorry,
I guess,
sorry. And it will be quite noisy for a second.
No problem.
We'll wait a minute because I can't hear you. Yeah, I'm with you now.
Okay. Wow, so I didn't realize you're actually in Palestine at this moment.
Yeah, I am in Palestine now, yes.
Is that part of your research or activism?
Well, it's part of the fact that I live in both places. My family is still here. I work in England, and so I'm trying to divide my time as much as I can and as long as I can between the two places, yeah.
Oh, wow. So I guess this would be a good segue to move on to what's happening right now as I'm very sure you know there's been an escalation of violence over the last week or so. Could you talk to our readers and listeners a little bit about what has happened and what sparked this latest flaring up of conflict?
Yeah, definitely. I think we should distinguish between the immediate background and the long-term background for what is unfolding in front of our eyes. The immediate background is a series of provocation instigated by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the moment he realized that he's not going to be able to form a government, and therefore might find himself on the way to court, to the courthouse, if not to the jailhouse. And in a very calculated, cynical way, he started a provocative action that he knew would force, in many ways, force the Hamas, at least symbolically, to react to them. This begins with putting barriers on the way of people who go to pray in Haram al-Sharif, the holiest place for Muslims in Palestine, and Al-Aqsa Mosque, then evicting by force or ethnically cleansing Palestinians from Jerusalem, and finally violating the sacredness of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest place for Muslims all over the world, and the most holy place for Muslims in Palestine, which is also a national symbol. It's not just a religious symbol. And he knew that the Hamas would react symbolically, and he used that pretext to retaliate with all the force of the Israeli army, used also settlers, fanatic settlers in the occupied territories, as a movement to steer a kind of a civil war inside Israel's mixed town, in order to create the sense that he needs to be in position, in power, for as long as this so-called emergency situation continues. The long term are, of course, the continued oppression of the Palestinians, whether it is the continued blockade and siege on Gaza, which makes it almost an inhabitable place to live in, the Israeli ethnic cleansing of Area C within the West Bank, which is 60% of the West Bank, where Israel is incrementally expelling the people, expropriating the lands, discriminatory kind of apartheid system which is imposed on the Palestinians inside Israel, and of course the continued predicament of the Palestinian refugees who are not allowed to return. Palestinians try to fight against this attempt to de-Arabize Palestine, to destroy them by various means, from non-violent means to more violent means. The balance is totally against them. But now and then there is an uprising, there is an attempt to change the reality, especially when the sense is that the world is not interested and there's no one there to help them to fight their existential fight for survival.
Mm. But wasn't there some more specific proximate cause of this latest outbreak? It had to do with the Al-Aqsa Mosque and then some scuffle.
I mentioned, Peter, yeah. I said it was very calculated. It was very clear that let me explain it again. When I said the Netanyahu planned a series of provocation, I included this one in it.
Oh, yes.
It was very clear that we know now from documents that were published in the Israeli press that the intelligence of the police told the government that if you're going to put boots on the ground in the sacred Haram al-Sharif, this would trigger a reaction all over historical Palestine. Right. They knew that this was what would happen. And nonetheless, and if you noticed, they did not only entered the space of Haram al-Sharif. On purpose, they entered with their boots into the mosque. Now, anybody who's a Muslim and anybody who is familiar with the Muslim religion understand what that message conveys when the occupier enters with their, not just shoes, I mean military shoes, into this. This was, of course, nobody was hurt physically from this. But this is part of to make sure that the provocation is not lost in this respect, and that's what I mean. You can never prevent an uprising after 50 years of occupation and 70 years of colonization, but you can affect its timing when it suits your political interest, as happened in the case of Netanyahu.
Okay, so could we talk a little bit about this last election that happened a few months ago? It seems that the Israeli voting public kind of just has moved further and further to the right, and moderate Zionists is increasingly a kind of minority faction, and then progressive Zionists seems to be almost like a tiny fringe. Right. What are your thoughts about what that says about the sort of prevailing mentality and attitudes amongst ordinary voting Israelis in the year 2021?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, I agree with your analysis. I think that there are only two viable political options among the Jewish electorate in Israel. One is center-right and one is extreme-right. There's no left, there is no liberal Zionist voice. There's no liberal Zionist force to reckon with. And these are the two options. And this already happened in 2000. So we are already 21 years into this reality where the Israeli electorate in large numbers does not believe in the kind of, I would call it fabrication, that the Zionist left was selling them, that you can be both an ethnic state and a democratic state, that you can be both an occupier and a liberal, you can be both a socialist and a colonizer. So this, even the Israeli public doesn't buy it anymore. So between the options of being democratic and racist, they prefer the latter option. How exactly to impose such a racist ethnic state on millions of Palestinians is open to debate in the Israeli society. And that's the difference between the center and the right. It seems that they need both, each of these two factions needs the other in order to form a government. And this could have been easily done in terms of domestic Israeli politics. The only problem is Netanyahu, that there's some decent people in the Israeli center, at least in this respect, who do not want a criminal prime minister to remain in office. And therefore, this kind of undermined a natural, if you want, an authentic representation of an electorate that really wants a right-wing government. There's no denying about it. Of course, the more important conclusion out of it is that we cannot expect for a change from within Israel. And the conclusion from that is that the only way of changing things is very strong pressure on Israel from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me then to a question I was hoping I could ask you about the one-state solution. I interviewed your colleague Norman Finkelstein in August of 2019. We discussed what was going on in the UK with the smear campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, and we also talked about Netanyahu and the hope for some kind of resolution to the conflict. And I brought up with him the issue of the one-state solution. And he describes people who support the one-state solution as, quote, posers and fantasists, and says that the proposal has, quote, nothing to do with politics and is, quote, little more than a graduate seminar at the LSE. I just wanted to see whether you wanted to respond to that. Why it is that you think that Professor Finkelstein is wrong and that there is a prospect for a one-state solution?
Yeah, definitely. I have a lot of respect for Norman. I think many of us have a lot of respect for his scholarship, for his activism. But I think on this point, he's totally wrong. And I think it also relates to the fact that he hasn't been here for many, many years. I don't think he realizes what's going on the ground. In fact, because we are realistic, because we understand politics, because we don't do graduate courses on the situation, we are part of the situation. Because of all of that, we know, and every visitor to historical Palestine would know it after 5 minutes, that there is no chance in the world for a two-state solution. So first of all, whether you like the idea or you don't like the idea, even if you think that the idea is good, you understand that it's not doable anymore. And then comes the question, what is doable? What is doable, unfortunately, at this very moment, is to reconcile with the fact that there is already a one-state solution. It's called the Apartheid Republic of Israel. It controls every part of historical Palestine in different means. It's a matrix of power that has different version to it, whether it's in the Gaza Strip, in the Galilee, or in the West Bank. Our task, the task of the Palestinian Liberation Movement, is now to ask, how can we make this apartheid state more democratic, more free, more liberated? This is a long-term project. This is not for tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. But it's definitely about change of regime and not the creation of Bantustan. It's definitely about decolonization and not a peace treaty between Israel and a fictitious Palestine that doesn't exist. These are the issues that we have now to figure out, and we should be led by the Palestinian National Movement. And I think that if you look at it from a generational point of view, and the Palestinian society is the youngest in the world, one of the youngest in the world, the younger Palestinian generation will move ahead eventually, I'm sure, with a vision of one state, and would find the way, or it would at least suggest the way of how to achieve it, And our role as people who are part of that solidarity movement from the outside or from the inside would be to go along with this project of decolonization and liberation. So it's you just have to be on the ground on the one hand. The second thing is a moral debate, which Norman is entitled to his views, but I have my own views on it. I don't think that the Palestinian problem, or I don't think that the Palestinians are only the people who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I don't think that Palestine is only in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It's only 22% of historical Palestine. I think the Palestinians include all the Palestinians in the world, including those who are refugees. And I think Palestine is the country from the river and the Jordan. And every part of it has to be liberated, and every Palestinian has to be liberated and be free. A two-state solution does not offer it. In fact, it offers a perpetuation of the colonization in other means.
Interesting. So I'm not trying to spark a debate, at least not between you.
Don't worry. You should.
But the argument, what do you make of the argument that Professor Finkelstein and others make that Israel is a state with borders that are internationally recognized, that it's a member of the UN, that it's a growing economy with a big tech sector and with ambassadors over the world, all over the world, and that it's not a reasonable, even though it was born in sin, many countries were born in sin, not least the United States, that it's just unreasonable now to ask a state just to sort of keel over and die and allow itself to be wiped off the map, and what's your response to that argument?
I wonder whether one would have made this argument with regard to apartheid South Africa. You know, apartheid South Africa would say to the world, "You're interfering. You want to totally change the state of South Africa. You want to make the whole of South Africa an African state. We in South Africa decided South Africa is divided into three. There are two Bantustan, there's one South Africa. Don't interfere." We are not talking about killing a state. We are talking of change, a regime change, from an apartheid regime to non-apartheid regime. This is within the international law. It's part of the international law. We have the right under the international law to ask for that. Presenting it as a question of whether Israel has the right to exist or not to exist is not the right framing for the discussion. The discussion is not about whether, you're right, many states may not have the right to exist or do have the right to exist, but there are regimes that don't have the right to exist. And you cannot say, okay, I agree with you, but that regime has the right to exist in 78% of Palestine, but not in 22% of Palestine. This is not working. I'm not even repeating the excellent arguments by Nora Erakat of the irrelevance of international law, not just to Palestine. Ask any indigenous person in the United States, any indigenous person in Australia, whether the international law, which is based on the Westphalian order that respects states, has anything to offer them in their struggles for liberation and equality. Ask any African American whether the international law that respects states has anything to do with what they are going through. Palestine is an area of colonialism. It's not an area where two states are fighting each other and then the international law about state may be relevant. It's totally irrelevant to what's going on in Palestine. It's a continued settler colonial project that has to be decolonized. And the international law has to adapt itself to decolonization, not to say, well, because there is international law, you cannot decolonize in the 21st century, which is what Norman is saying, which is totally wrong. Logically, morally, and politically.
Okay, last one on this, I promise. another argument that Professor Finkelstein and others make is that all of the countries in the world support a two-state solution, the UN supports a two-state solution, that it already has this framework, this blueprint, that he says that there isn't even a major political party, including leftist political parties, that actually is promoting the idea of a one-state solution. So if that's the case, then his argument, as I understand it, would be, well, what's the framework from getting to A to B?
Well, the framing is very clear. The framing is very clear. I'm part of a popular movement for one democratic state moved forward by Palestinians. And there is a popular movement supporting the one state solution. It will take time to build it. It will take time for it to convince the Palestinian leaders to adopt it. But there is an alternative, both organizational alternative and definitely an ideological. I don't understand this idea of so many states in the world support something. Many states in the world support injustice in so many parts of the world. So as activists, we should stop working for justice if there is a consensus, not between people. This is a consensus between the states. I can assure you that if you do a referendum among people, among societies, among the civil society, there is a much, and I know it from my own intuitive visits to these countries, there's a far greater support in the civil societies all over the world to the idea of the one-state solution than to the idea of the two-state solution. You're talking about the consensus of the corrupt political elites that definitely are not our moral compass. Definitely, it's irrelevant even that they have this support because they don't even do anything towards that solution as well. I mean, they don't really care about two states. When was the last time did you see any active pressure on Israel to accept the two-state solution? This is just this is just a discourse which allows everyone not to do anything because you talk about the two-state solutions, you don't have to do anything. If you talk about the one-state solution, you have to do something because the one-state solution says Israel now is either an apartheid state or the whole of Palestine would be a democratic state. Where do you stand? This is an important question for Jews around the world. If you tell Jews around the world there's a two-state solution, say, okay, that's fine. We can support the racist apartheid state of Israel and support peace because next to the apartheid state of Israel, there will be a Palestinian Bantustan and that's it. And why should we support it? Because so many governments in the world support it. I'm sorry, this is an awkward way of arguing for people who should be not be defeated by realpolitik, but which should challenge realpolitik.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to be clear, I'm not an expert on the subject.
No, that's okay.
I'm just a fellow traveler who is sort of...
I'm glad you bring it up. I think it's an important discussion, by the way, and I don't think it should divide us. We all stand for Palestine, one status and two status, and we should work together. But it's a valid and legitimate debate. Not everybody uses the abusive language of Norman Finkelstein. There's no need for that, but... That's okay. That's the man, and this is the style. Sometimes we like it when it's directed against others. We like it less when it's directed towards us. But the important thing is not the style. It's the content, the substance of the argument.
What do you make of the situation with the Palestinian Authority? Some people argue that the Palestinian leadership has become corrupt and collaborationist, and now holds this sort of fiefdom with the Palestinian Authority, and that, and it seems to me that the Fatah seems to be committed to the two-state solution. So do you think that itself might become an impediment to peace and to resolution of the conflict?
It's not the major impediment. It is an impediment, of course. It's a structure that was built by Oslo in order to subcontract Israeli control over the Palestinians. But it's a complex subject because the PA includes a lot of people who devoted their life to the Palestinian struggle. So it's I think people from the outside sometimes don't understand that it's not that easy to delegitimize the Fatah that really played a very important role in the struggle for the liberation of Palestine. Yes, the present outfit is not ideal, and I think in the end would have to be dismantled if we want to decolonize Palestine. But people should first offer an alternative. If you don't like that kind of political structure of representation, we should offer, or the Palestinians should offer. I would follow them. The Palestinians should offer an alternative structure of representation, an authentic one, a democratic one. And then when you have this in place, maybe it's the old PLO outfits, maybe it's a new kind of organization, before you do that, I don't think you can that easily create these dangerous vacuums where you get rid of something that you're rightly challenging it, but the only good way of replacing it is to have already an idea what you want to have instead of it. Because otherwise, you contribute to already a very chaotic and dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. Is there a faction within Palestinian politics that you think has the best analysis and program? I personally probably associate myself most closely with the PFLP. And find that their analysis to be very nuanced. Do you see something within PAL that you think is exciting, a bit more fresh, a bit more vibrant, that you could maybe put your support behind as a solidarity person?
As someone on the left and a socialist, of course, the PFLP is very close to me. I am very close to the PFLP, rather, vision not only of Palestine, but also of the Arab world, and I pray for it. But I think we have to be realistic and to look for a more consensual kind of Palestine where we do not sideline the political Islamic groups, which are an important part of our life. Islam is important part of the life of Palestinians, not just their religion, but also as civilization. So I don't think I'm looking for a particular faction. What I am inspired by is the younger generation, which I follow closely either through their websites, their networks, or from my own contact with them. And I think they are brewing new ideas of both the end game, if you want, but also how to get there. It's not easy to do it under the present circumstances. We saw what happened in 2008 when Occupy Wall Street was trying to do it, when the Arab Spring was trying to do it. There are still issues. And I think they are very closely connected to movements of democracy and change in the Arab world. We have to remember, they don't see themselves just locked in Palestine. They see Israel locked in the Arab world. Mm. They don't feel a minority. In this respect, they feel a majority. They think that the Israelis are a minority of settlers within an Arab world that needs to be changed. It needs to be changed. So I think there are some ideas that are not, they're half-baked, they are not yet fully articulate. We are going through a very dangerous time because this is the limbo between the old ideas and the new ideas. It's always a dangerous time in history, but I think these new ideas would, I'm hopeful that they will mature into not just sound bites or slogans, but into a more practical program. And I think the left has to play a very important role in this because of its experience in organizations, its past fight for social justice, so that social justice is not forgotten in the fight for liberation, that the impact of neoliberalism on our society is not disregarded as part of the problem, and that fighting against it is part of the solution. That's why, like you, I feel that the PFLP, of course, as a leftist organization, has these ideas, but they need to be adapted to the reality of 2021 and be relevant, not just to hardcore leftists, but relevant to large sections of the mm-hmm. Palestinians, wherever they are.
Excellent. Okay, if I could just have one last question. I'll make it a two-part. What do you see the future holding? First of all, in terms of the current escalation of violence that we've seen in the last few weeks, and then two, over, say, the next 2-3 years, in terms of progress towards some kind of resolution, what do you see happening with Netanyahu's government and so on?
Yeah, well, always very dangerous to predict. I think with regard to your first question, I can only judge as an historian what happened in the past. These cycles of violence tend to peter out eventually.
Yeah,
with a lot of particularly damage on the side of Gaza in terms of human cost, infrastructure, augmenting already an impossible reality for people to live in. and I'm afraid this would be one of the consequences. And therefore, I'm more worried about it than about the question when exactly it would end, because it will end eventually. Both sides, by the way, would claim that they had done very well in this cycle. The more important question, you're right, about the next 2 or 3 years. I don't expect a comprehensive solution to be on the table even for discussion in the next 2 or 3 years. What I think is going to happen is that we will see on the negative side even more brutal Israeli policies, more tensions between Jews and Arabs inside the state of Israel. That's on the negative side. On the more positive side, I think that the sense of solidarity and unity and determination of the younger generation would be more visible than it is today, in terms of not just being there, but beginning to offer alternatives, both to the Fatah and the Hamas on the Palestinian side. I don't expect something similar to happen on the Israeli side, but I do expect something similar to happen to the American Jewish community, to Jewish communities around the world, and also other kind of locations where traditionally were pro-Israelis and are now at the forefront of showing solidarity with the Palestinian people. 2-3 years won't enable us to see this change in full, but hopefully we'll see a trend that will tell us that maybe there is a potential here for a bit longer future to unfold as a new reality.
Excellent. Well, just before we sign off, just do you have 2 minutes to say, most of our readers in the Canary are in the UK, we have some in the US, other English-speaking countries. Just very quickly, could you just say what you think we as non-Palestinians, solidarity activists, can do to help the situation in our day-to-day lives?
Yeah, I think there is an excellent organization now that galvanizes and knows how to use your solidarity in the most effective way. This is the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement. It has different versions in different places according to the circumstances, but I think being part of it is very helpful, is very much appreciated and respected by the Palestinians on the ground. I think that if you are a teacher or a lecturer in university, try to make sure that, especially if you teach history and so on, make sure that they are also using your other hat as a professional, in whatever profession, to make sure that you inform people. I always said, and with this I would end, but this was not so possible in the age of Corona, and probably is not that possible now exactly, but maybe it will be in the future. I would say to people, be VIPs, namely visit if you can, inform and protest. I don't think you can do more than that from the outside, but if you do it effectively, it's very, very significant.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, for your very informative comments. That was Ilan Pape, professor of history at Exeter, author of many books. Thank you again, Professor, for your time. This has been very valuable.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon, hopefully.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
You have been listening to historian and professor Ilan Pape in conversation with Peter Bolton of the Canary Channel in the United Kingdom. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.